Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest is Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, as she's known in the blogosphere, EmptyWheel.net. And she's been working very hard on getting to the bottom of this mystery of which all presidential powers to kill are being asserted by our current Emperor Barack Obama. Welcome back to the show, Marcy. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us here today. And I know, actually, I think because of you, I know that Jason Leopold, I guess, got his hands on a copy of the white paper that doesn't have NBC News graffitied all over it, that's, you know, actually legible. So if there's actually anything that you were able to dig out of that clean version of the memo that's worthy of note, maybe we should just start there since our last discussion.
Yeah, so this white paper was leaked right before John Brennan testified, and then a couple of days later, Jason Leopold got a copy that he had originally FOIA'd and had been giving expedited processing for last August. So all of a sudden it became okay to give him the FOIA. And, you know, one of the things that became clear as you were able to read it is that the white paper really tries to play this double game where every step of its legal argument, it says this is true under the AUMF, under the authorization to use military force, and this is also true under the president's authority to protect the nation from an imminent threat. So there's this dual structure to the white paper, which becomes clear once you can read it. And that's actually really interesting because most people commenting publicly are saying, oh, Obama did this under the AUMF, and he actually did it at best under a joint invocation of the AUMF and his Article II power as president. But there are hints that it might have been just the Article II power, and we don't really know. I mean, that's, I guess, one of the reasons why we should get to see that the actual memos rather than, you know, this white paper that they produced for public consumption.
Mm-hmm. Right. Of course, yeah, I should have explained that at the beginning here, that it was not the actual memo. It was a white paper to Congress explaining what the memo might say if we were to ever let you see it.
Right, and it's actually an interesting, I mean, one of the things I did is compare what Eric Holder said publicly last year.
Actually, wait, hold that for a second, because, well, I don't know, maybe this goes on the other end of the thing you're going to say, but anyway, I wonder whether you think the reason that it's half Article II, that means Article II of the Constitution that creates the presidency, the dual aspect argument, it's part the authorization to use military force, it's part Article II of the Constitution. Is that just what George W. Bush used to call disassembling, trying to distract us and confuse us in order to get away with what's actually just plainly illegal?
Well, yeah, it may well be. I mean, one of the reasons I became really interested in this white paper is because Ron Wyden kept asking, and I don't know whether he knows the answer to this now or not, but for over a year he was asking, did you kill al-Awlaki, Anwar al-Awlaki, based on the AUMF, or did you kill him based on basically Article II power, commander-in-chief power? And he didn't know. And this is a guy in the Senate Intelligence Committee who had been briefed by the administration on what they had done, and he had no idea. And that, you know, that was what got me interested in which it was once you looked at the white paper. And he had started asking this question before the white paper was actually released to Congress, although after it was written. And then he kept asking and asking and asking. So, you know, for somebody who was purportedly briefed at the highest level about this killing not to even know, that was alarming to me, and we still don't know that answer, although a lot of the people who are commenting publicly keep saying, oh, yeah, it was it was the AUMF. No need to worry about it because the AUMF has clear limits and isn't what George Bush did. But we don't know that. We just don't know.
Okay, so who's Colleen McMahon?
Colleen McMahon is the judge who presided in one of two FOIA suits that the ACLU has taken. They in the D.C. district, they asked for basically all the paperwork behind the targeted killing program, the drone program. They didn't say targeted killing in that one. In New York, in Colleen McMahon's court, they asked for all of the documentation behind Alaki's killing or the authorization to kill Americans. So they had two parallel FOIAs going at once, not exactly the same, but they were similar. And at the beginning of January, Colleen McMahon basically ruled for the government, saying that ACLU couldn't get anything more than what they've gotten, which is basically a talking point document and a couple of on indices. And that, you know, most people just stopped reading there. Most people just stopped, you know, kind of following what was going on there. And I decided, I mean, her ruling was interesting in any case because she alluded to an earlier ruling in the torture FOIA that ACLU also pursued. And that ruling basically held that the government could hide the fact that the torture program had been authorized on what's called a memorandum of notification, basically on Article 2 power, on the president telling the CIA to do something as part of a covert operation and telling Congress. And the government in that earlier FOIA had been successful in hiding even like a few word mention that made it clear that the president had personally authorized the torture program, and that's all the authority it had at the beginning of the program. And I think she alludes to that decision, although not in a really obvious way in the unclassified portion of her opinion, but I suspect she discussed it at quite a bit more length in the classified section, which leads me to believe one of the things they're arguing in this case is that it's the same memorandum notification, which we know to be true, and since the circuit court had already said this memorandum of notification can remain secret, therefore this FOIA case will go nowhere. So that's what we knew at the beginning of January. And I thought, since we've seen this white paper, it'd be interesting to go back and see what Colleen McMahon actually said, and whether it looked like she had seen the white paper or not. And that's when things got interesting, because there's a section of Colleen McMahon's opinion which really hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but she basically says, oh, it was illegal. So she kind of interrupts what she's doing, which is purportedly judging on whether or not the government can withhold these FOIA documents. And she says, hold on a second. Due process is the most fundamental part of our constitutional government. That's part of what the rebels against King George III were fighting for. And it goes back to the Magna Carta. And she said, we also in the Constitution have a treason clause, which says before you can deny anybody of their citizenship, you have to go to a judge. She kind of very astutely pointed out that it's on Article 3, meaning it's part of the courts, this guarantee that before the executive branch deprives you of your citizenship, you have to go before a judge. And then she looked at a couple of more pieces that correlate really interestingly with the white paper. In particular, there's a domestic statute that says you can't murder an American overseas. And she said, wait a second, you can't murder an American overseas, and even the president, that, you know, that should cover the president. And even when he's authorizing covert operations, as we know this to be, he can't authorize people to do something that breaks American law. So she lays out four reasons why, what the administration had done with Alaki, doesn't adhere to the principles of the Constitution.
But then at the same time, she's ruling, but who am I? I'm just some judge, and I don't have standing to get involved in any of this or to even legalize the pieces of paper that describe why it's legal.
Right, and I think if I'm right about that earlier precedent, I think that's why. I mean, that to go against such an obviously pertinent precedent would be unheard of. Just because it's actually, I mean, they might have well ruled on this particular issue specifically because that's what they did. And this was just last year that they ruled. So in other words, you know, under the way our courts work, I think she probably, her hands probably were tied, but she went out of her way to include this 5-page section, which then, you know, if I were the ACLU and I'm suing, in a wrongful death case, in D.C. for Al-Awlaki and Al-Awlaki's son and Samir Khan, I would point to this and say, look, a judge has reviewed this and found these four reasons why these deaths were wrongful.
Right. Hey, that's a very good point. Would you suspect then, I guess there's no point in asking you your suspicion, but seems like maybe that's why she did it, so that even though it's, in a way, it's not exactly relevant to what she's deciding here, but she's just putting it on paper so that somebody else can quote her later, almost. Seems like.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it doesn't count as a legal precedent, but it's the kind of thing that other court cases can point to and say, and nobody else, I mean, it may be that no one else gets to review the exact same documents that she got to review. We don't even know what she's gotten to review. We don't know whether she got a peek at the white paper. She did say in her ruling that she didn't feel the need to look at the classified OLC memos because, for a variety of reasons. She did also hint that it may not be the OLC memos that the administration relied on when they killed Al-Awlaki, which is interesting because if they were relying on that earlier memorandum notification, then, you know, they could hide the OLC memo because it was a draft and it was deliberative and they didn't rely on it. They could hide the memorandum notification because in that circuit it is, you know, there's a directly relevant precedent. And then they could hide all of their rationalizations, but they had to say to her, and here's something else interesting. They had to say to her, we are withholding not just the documents, but any description of the documents because they're super secret. And they had to give an explanation to her for why they were so super secret. And one of the funny things that I also kind of, I mean, I sort of knew, but I sort of figured out finally, is that the CIA in this case had said, we're going to Glomar. We're going to tell you we can't tell you whether we have documents or not. And then after they did this big press campaign last year when Eric Holder gave a very public speech describing how they killed Al-Awlaki, although not naming Al-Awlaki, they said, well, we can tell you that we have documents, but we can't tell you how many and what they are. But what's interesting is they said, we can tell you that we have Attorney General's speech. We can tell you that we have John Brennan's speech, period. And they didn't admit what we also know and is obvious, is that they also have a speech made by their own general counsel about what the CIA needs before they get involved in a lethal force covert operation, which is what Al-Awlaki's killing was. And that one actually says, we can go just on Article 2. We don't need an AUMF sort of gravy.
Huh. I don't know what to make of it all.
Yeah, they're trying to hide the fact that this public speech pertains to this question at hand, which is can the administration kill Americans based solely on presidential say-so?
Right. Well, and the point is all of this, they're trying to keep it all secret because they know it's nonsense, right? Just like when the John Yoo memos finally were published and I guess beginning in 2004 and then finally the rest of them in 2008, everybody said, oh, my God, this is ridiculous.
Right. And you know, there's a strain of commentary. Both Jane Mayer and David Cole wrote articles saying, you know, this isn't as bad as what John Yoo did and Bush did because torture is always illegal and sometimes killing is legal. And Obama was operating under the AUMF and killing in times of war is legal. And therefore, it's just not as bad as authorizing torture. But what they ignore is this Article 2 part. In fact, they sort of suggest that Obama's not just invoking Article 2 when we don't know, and B, there's a lot of reasons to suggest that's actually exactly what he's doing.
Right, and gee, I guess I'm sorry, it sort of goes without saying, but it shouldn't, for people who maybe don't remember, weren't paying attention then, what was so ridiculous from the Yoo memos was his claim that the president has inherent plenary authority under Article 2 to override any law, any part of the Constitution, other than the phrase, he's the commander-in-chief of it all.
Right, and that's what, at a minimum, we know that they had to have done. And they did invoke the, you know, in the white paper, at least, they sort of, like I said, they used this dual structure, and they kept saying, under the AUMF, okay, under Article 2, okay, under the AUMF, okay, under Article 2, okay. And it's that domestic statute that says you can't murder Americans overseas, which is what the, I mean, what the bulk of the white paper spent new time on. Eric Holder didn't mention it in his public, speech, but it's like 4 or 5 pages of the 16-page white paper. So that they were clearly pretty worried about it. And the argument they make in the white paper to excuse it is basically to say, if you are operating under the public authority and you do these things, it doesn't count as murder. So in other words, and it sort of makes sense, right? If you're a soldier and your job is to go kill people, to go kill the enemy, then if you go kill an American overseas, you're just doing your job. Your public authority says that your job is to go kill an American. And that's sort of what they argue, except the problem is that doesn't work for CIA, because CIA is not supposed to, in covert ops, be able to do something that's illegal in the United States. And then moreover, and there's actually one legal opinion which makes this argument. Oh, there's a number. I mean, the other problem that they had is that the CIA is the one that killed Awlaki, as far as we know. And the CIA, they're not soldiers. And so all of the rules that apply to soldiers, which are invoked in the white paper, don't necessarily or don't really apply to the CIA. So, you know, you can't argue that you're doing this. It introduces all sorts of problems once you have the CIA press the button. And yet, it appears that's what they did, and that's why this document and the killing is so much more legally problematic than if they had evidence to prove he was operational, if they had the willingness of the Yemeni government, then they could have just killed him if DOD had done it. And for some reason, they didn't do it that way, and instead used CIA, probably didn't give the Yemeni government a full heads up, and then introduced all sorts of legal problems.
So why? Just because Petraeus wanted to do it? It was a bureaucratic turf battle kind of thing, or what?
You know, it's funny that it worked out that way, because they first tried to kill Awlaki in December of 2009. And what's really interesting about that, and what everyone should remember, is that according to a report that William Webster released last year, it was an investigation into the Nidal Hassan Fort Hood killing. And they looked at exactly what the FBI knew when. And it says very clearly, the FBI and the intelligence community generally did not consider Awlaki operational until the December 25th underwear bombing. So in other words, they're very clear that on December 24th, when they tried to kill him, they didn't consider him operational. They didn't consider him operational until the next day or probably several weeks afterward when they started collecting evidence. And so, in other words, had they actually succeeded in killing them 2 weeks after they first tried to, it probably would have been legal. I mean, because they probably would have had at least decent evidence that he was operational, ties to Al-Qaeda, yada, yada. There's a problem because the U.S. government had not yet declared AQAP a terrorist group at that point. So there are problems, but at least, you know, this whole AUMF argument would have made sense. But then, after they switched course, and after they decided to get a memo authorizing this, and after they decided, you know, after they had the interrogation from the underwear bomber, whatever that said, then they switched course and put CIA in charge of it. And the funny thing is, as you said, David Petraeus was in charge of CENTCOM in December 2009, and then he was in charge of CIA in September 2011. And so it's sort of David Petraeus all along, although I don't think that, you know, he was just determined to kill Awlaki, but that's sort of what happened.
Well, now, so what do you make about this, the question of whether Obama can kill Americans with drones or otherwise here in the United States, as long as, like, say, for the case of the Miami 7, some snitch gets them to say they love Osama into a tape recorder, and so then what? Just blow them up? Can they do that? Is that is the power of the whole world's battlefield and all of that? Sounds like all those same legal theories are continuing here, right?
Yeah. Tune in later this week because I think I'm going to make an argument. I'm going to show exactly what a targeted killing in the United States would look like with an actual killing. Not done by DOD, not done by CIA as far as we know, but of somebody who was alleged to be a leader of a terrorist group and was killed. And you know, we'll never know at this point when things like that happen, whether they happened because the president ordered them or because some cowboy went nuts with his gun when they were pursuing a criminal.
Mm-hmm. Now, so are you talking about Kennedy and the brothers or black civil rights leaders or?
Precisely.
Yeah.
I mean, the case I'm going to show actually encapsulates all of that in a remarkable way. So that's the thing is, in the discussions generally, can the president authorize the killing of an American? He's focused, you know, most people have focused on the AUMF side, and there at least is a strong aspect of Article 2 in it, given what the white paper says, given what the judge who had looked at this says, given what the general counsel of the CIA says, there's at least a strong component of Article 2, if not only Article 2. And then the other thing about whether or not, and this is the problem, I mean, Rand Paul is persisting and threatening a hold on John Brennan's nomination, and he's saying, I want to know whether you can kill with a drone in the United States. The correct question and the question that Ron Wyden was asking was, I want to know whether the president can order the death of an American, but it probably won't be by drone. It'll be by some other means.
Yeah, hitman, single car accident, that kind of thing.
Yeah, or, yeah.
Or but, all of a sudden he got cancer.
I don't know if they would go to that trouble, but but at least not here in the United States. But, you know, I mean, I've gone back to remember when Fred Hampton died, the Black Panther leader, right? Totally assassinated, total overkill. And I keep wondering whether there's a memo that authorized that somewhere that said, you know, okay, the FBI can go in and kill somebody that we believe to be, you know, a leader of a militant group opposing the United States. And, you know, I just think back in those days they didn't get memos to do everything, but we've seen it before. It usually is African Americans. Now it would be Muslims, but they don't get memos for poor guys who challenge power in this country.
Yeah, it seems like that's more the kind of thing where, like, hey, Jimmy, make sure that that guy's not breathing by tomorrow morning kind of a thing, rather than an official order.
And, well, but the thing is, we'll never know. I mean, the Fred Hampton case is an example where we know that the White House was going nuts about the Black Panthers. We know that the FBI had developed this entire spy network and had infiltrated them and was driving them to increased violence. So it is very similar to what we see going on with the Al-Qaeda network now. It happened in the United States, and it's precisely that kind of action that led to purportedly putting limits on the CIA so they couldn't break the law in the United States.
Yeah. When John Yoo wrote up his memos, and he had it, and I think this one didn't come out till the end, really, although maybe it was purely consistent with the rest of them anyway, I don't know. But it was the one that it broke along with the story that Cheney had pushed to use the army to go and arrest the Lackawanna Six, so-called Lackawanna Six there from Buffalo.
Right.
And Bush, in his wisdom and calm patience, had decided that, no, we'll just let the FBI handle it. But remember
that the very first American killed in a drone strike
was their buddy in Yemen.
Right. And so yes, as far as we know, the military wasn't involved in Lackawanna outside of Buffalo, but that is an example where, and the argument there, and there was another guy who was killed in Somalia in 2008, and they claimed Al-Awlaki the first time we tried to kill him, although there's a WikiLeaks cable which makes it pretty clear this isn't the case. They claimed that those three incidences, and probably Samir Khan's death, and probably Abdulrahman Al-Awlaki, the 16-year-old son's death, were all what I call the sitting next to a baddie logic, mm-hmm. meaning you know, they weren't really aiming for Kamal Darwish. They were aiming for the guy sitting next to him. He just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Wait, wait. You're saying that they keep claiming this in the case of the son, in the case of the guy in Somalia, in the case of the Lackawanna Six friend and the seventh guy there back in 02, but that also you caught them lying and claiming that, oh, yeah, gee, we only accidentally, Alaki himself was only going to be an innocent bystander in one of these things until they missed him.
Right. I mean, that's one of the other underlying tensions. We know, because William Webster has told us in no uncertain terms, that the day they tried to kill Alaki in 2009, he was not considered operational. So the entire white paper doesn't apply because it's only supposed to apply to senior operational leaders. They didn't believe him to be that. But we also know that after they missed, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the then president of Yemen, went to David Petraeus and said, oops, we missed Muhaishi and Al-Laki, and made it very clear that Al-Laki was one of the two targets, and also referred to him as the cleric. He didn't refer to him as having any tie to AQAP. And so that memo makes it very clear that Al-Laki was a named target of that strike.
And now, can we rewind a little bit to the evidence implicating Al-Laki? Everybody knows that the Pentagon invited him to breakfast or something like that after September 11th. It was later on that he became a problem. But the best I could tell, and we talked about this before, the Washington Post, at least at one point, the worst thing that they were willing to say anonymously about Al-Laki in the Washington Post was that we believe he may have ties to. And then later, I think it was after that, well, he wrote an article for their magazine, and he did a bunch of YouTubes, you know, denouncing American foreign policy. I didn't watch them. Perhaps he encourages people to attack the United States, something like that. What is the actual evidence that he was really operational rather than an opinion columnist or, YouTuber? And after all, because not only is he just using his American-born natural right of free speech, but he's actually a religious cleric, so he's got a First Amendment double whammy on his side, it sounds like. And plus the Brandenburg versus Ohio case, too.
Right, right. And he definitely has incited people to violence, or he has called for violence against the United States. So that much is clear. And I don't think there's, you know, he's not a nice guy. He's not, you know, looking out for you and I. But the best evidence against him comes from the underwear bombing case. And when Abdulmutallab was sentenced, the government presented a paper that said Abdulmutallab testified that Al-Laki told him to wait until he to ignite the bomb until he was over the United States. And it says that Al-Laki gave him other kinds of directions. So if that document is to be believed, then Al-Laki clearly had a directional role in the underwear bombing case. The problem with that is Abdulmutallab immediately confessed after he was caught on Christmas Day 2009. And he said somebody else gave him the orders. For some things, he said Ibrahim al-Assiri, who is Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's bomb maker. For another, he said this guy, Abu Tarak, who no one has ever heard of, ordered him to do a couple of key things. And in that first confession, Abdulmutallab said only that Al-Laki told him to make a martyrs video. And what's interesting about that is the later confessions that tied to Al-Laki came in the course of plea negotiations. So basically the FBI appears to have been saying, if you say that Al-Laki did it, we'll give you an easier time in prison. And for a long time, when they thought that they were going to get Abdulmutallab to plea, they were at the same time thinking of actually charging Al-Laki. But then in September of 2010, Abdulmutallab fired his lawyer, said that, you know, there was a conflict of interest between what they wanted and what he wanted. And after that, DOJ, as far as we know, stopped its efforts to indict Al-Laki. So in other words, the best piece of evidence they have is what Abdulmutallab confessed to, but the government went on to agree with Abdulmutallab not to enter any of that into the primary case against him. And in fact, when they made their opening argument in the Abdumatullah case in 2011, after, just in the days as it happened, in the days after al-Awlaki was killed, they gave the old story, this Abu Tarak story, that al-Asturi had a bigger role, that Abu Tarak was the guy who told him to wait until he was over the United States. And so we, you know, that is easily the best evidence that they have. But even there's this big question about whether Abdumatullah was saying that it was al-Awlaki just because the FBI was going to give him an easier time to do that.
Mm. Well, and what about the Fort Hood shooter? They say he was tied to him, but what does that mean?
No, he wasn't. I mean, he was tied to him. He had conversations with him. But there were 16 or 18 emails, most of which were Nidal Hassan writing to al-Awlaki and making veiled requests for help. And for the most part, al-Awlaki was totally unresponsive, just blew them off. And the one that he replied most to was when Nidal Hassan basically set his ego and said, oh, you know, there's a lot of people here who worship you. Do you want to come and be hailed as a hero? And he's like, oh, yeah, now I'm listening. You know, now I'm listening if you're going to give me money to make public appearances. And so while those emails and things that Nidal Hassan said to al-Awlaki should have led the FBI to look more closely at Nidal Hassan, there's no indication at all that al-Awlaki was directing Nidal Hassan to move towards violence. And in fact, their exchanges stopped, I think, in June, and the attack was, I think, November. So there definitely was conversation. And I think when you look at the first explanations that Dennis Blair gave in February of 2010 for why al-Awlaki was a legitimate target, he basically said people are a legitimate target if their actions led to actions that threatened the American people. So in other words, he wasn't saying that people are a legitimate target if their actions threaten the American people, but instead saying that they're a legitimate target if their actions led to actions that threaten the American people, which could describe what happened with Nidal Hassan. I mean, he certainly inspired Nidal Hassan. Hassan turned to violence. But he didn't tell him to do what he did. He just was good at inspiring other people to violence.
And I'm sorry for keeping you so long, but I want to ask you about al-Awlaki's son. It seemed like to me that maybe they believed their own nonsense about how old he was and that they really were trying to kill him. Because, well, he's a terrorist, too, and he's 20-something years old, which means he's fair game. And then they found out that, oops, he was 16. Or am I reading that wrong? Were they trying to kill somebody else, and he was just a bystander? Or how's that work, Marcy?
No matter how you assess the government's actions, their actions in the Abdulrahman case, I think, are particularly bad. Because he was born in the United States. And to suggest that we don't know everything about the al-Awlaki immediate family, including the age of his son, who was born here in the United States, is just farcical, utterly farcical. And so it may be that once we killed him, we got worried, or the government got worried and said, oh, well, he was 21, and tried to hide the fact that that they knew he was 16. But I see absolutely no way to believe that the government didn't know he was 16 when they claimed he was 20.
Clear, wasn't it, that he was no ideological follower of his father. He went there to get him.
Right, and there's no evidence. I mean, there's no one. I think some people off the record in very hesitant ways have said, oh, yeah, you know, he was a legitimate target. But no one who's come close to making a public statement has ever implicated him in being a member of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and in sharing his father's ideological views. And so, the best case to be made is that he fell under, you know, John Brennan works under what is now called the military age male standard, which means that they believe any military age male in the vicinity of a known target is a legitimate target himself and must be a militant. And from this guy or their military age male standards are actually include children, I mean, you know, for all we know, and in fact, the government just reauthorized, as they do, I think it's been a bunch of years in a row, just reauthorized, there's a rule that says you can't give aid to a country that uses child soldiers.
Right.
And if you want to give aid to a country in spite of that, the president has to issue a waiver. Well, that waiver for Yemen was just signed yesterday or the day before or something. Mm-hmm. So in other words, one of the things that is true is that the United States gives funding to Yemen knowing that the official government of Yemen uses kids of the age of 16 to fight their wars as well.
Right.
And so.
Well, and Yemen was their perfect, it was their perfect test case or their model for how to handle the Arab Spring as best they could. Oh, you really, really hate this guy? Well, here's his cousin. We'll put him in a one-man election and hail it as the triumph of democracy.
Right, yeah, exactly.
All right. Listen, thank you so much. You teach me so much stuff. I'm going to be thinking about it all afternoon trying to figure it all out, too. Thanks very much for your time, Marcy.
Take care, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is the great Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net. Go and read all of the brilliant stuff she wrote, including the war and intelligence behind Anwar al-Awlaki's targeting, and Colleen McMahon, the covert op that killed Anwar al-Awlaki was illegal. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at FFF.org. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, JINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.